May it please the court. My name is Howard Beledoff, and I'm here representing the appellants today. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, please. The appellants brought this case to challenge the city ordinances prohibiting camping and disorderly conduct for sleeping under the Eighth Amendment. The plaintiffs sought declaratory injunctive relief as well as some damages. The plaintiffs sought to prevent the enforcement of these statutes when the homeless shelters in Boise were full. The issues today for the court concern the district court's dismissal of the prospective injunctive and declaratory relief, as well as the dismissal under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine for lack of subject matter jurisdiction of the retrospective relief.
Could I ask you a question on the prospective relief? It's unclear to me whether you are challenging the constitutional validity of the new altered ordinance as well. And if not, maybe you could address the circumstances in which a changed statute or ordinance renders prospective relief moot.
Yes, Your Honor, we are challenging the change in the ordinance, but
so your view is that it still is not constitutional?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it's not only ordinance, because the ordinance was only amended to somewhat define the definition of camping. The disorderly conduct ordinances were not amended, and now what the city did was issue what they called a special order. And we contend that order, because of its deficiencies, do not justify a voluntary secession dismissal, and do justify the voluntary secession exception to the mootness doctrine. And I know the court asked me to address the White case and the American Transport case, and I can do that right now, or I can go into the special order, whatever the court prefers. But I think it's really clear that those two cases are certainly distinguishable from that special order. There are so many, in my view, deficiencies that would not meet the Davis two-part standard, would not meet the formidable, the heavy burden, the stringent standard that the city had to admit to find that there was no reasonable expectation that the illegal conduct would recur, or that the interim relief or events would completely and irrevocably eradicate the illegal conduct. We don't think they met the burden. We think the circumstances are such that the special order could not do that. We know that the special order was completely voluntary. We know that it was unmonitored. We know it was so vague, it used terminology, available space. They had a separate protocol that talked about space or the shelters being full. And there was no definition. It's not tied to anything.
So, counsel, is your primary challenge to the ordinance as modified by the order vagueness?
We're not challenging the vagueness decision, Your Honor. We just believe that given how it defines camping and the fact that the disorderly conduct specifically prohibits sleeping, and I think that the new definition in camping also prohibits sleeping, that we're contending that it continues to violate the Eighth Amendment. It hasn't eradicated the effects of the violations.
Okay, so your primary challenge to the ordinance is an Eighth Amendment challenge?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the changes did not make the permanent change necessary because it didn't provide those definitions. And the evidence was such, for example, that two of the shelters used a definition of actual capacity. And what that meant was a janitor went through the shelters and they figured out how many mats they could put on the floor 36 inches apart. Okay, no concern over safety and fire codes. in one shelter, the shelter capacity, space, however you want to call it, went from 37 beds to 117 beds. And so no wonder they never called. They never had to fit that many people in there. But that doesn't mean that shelter was available in the sense where you can pack them in, violate fire and safety, and endanger those people.
Counsel, could you articulate for me precisely the contours of your Eighth Amendment challenge?
Well, Your Honor, it's really based upon the Jones decision that was vacated. Mm-hmm. But the Eighth Amendment challenge is that the city is punishing the status of homelessness. And they don't have any safe harbors under the ordinances. They don't have, they don't tie, as Jones indicates, any kind of criminal conduct to a violation of the camping.
Okay, so given that Jones has been vacated, what's your closest decision that supports your argument that this ordinance, by targeting the status of the people who've been cited, violates the Eighth Amendment?
Well, that was the Supreme Court. Jones is based upon the Supreme Court's decisions of Robertson and Powell, Your Honor, and their interpretation. We basically agree with that interpretation, but I don't think the district court never really reached that issue because
is that before us, or are we strictly here on whether dismissal was proper or not proper?
In my view, Your Honor, because it was summary judgment and the court's decision, that I don't believe the merits of the Eighth Amendment are here before the court. I believe that if the court didn't have jurisdiction under the mootness doctrine and Rooker-Feldman, how could it get to the merits? And I believe that there were disputes in fact that it couldn't render a summary judgment.
So we're here really on the procedural issues in your view?
That's what I believe, Your Honor. And that is the focus of most of my brief.
And with respect to the retrospective relief, why wouldn't the Heck doctrine, Heck versus Humphrey, be a problem? I know that's not something that the parties have decided to rely on, but if you obtain damages for having been convicted under this ordinance, isn't that a collateral attack on the conviction that should have been brought at the time by appealing the conviction?
Well, Your Honor, that kind of folds into the Rooker-Feldman analysis. And
well, they're separate issues. Heck deals only with criminal cases, and in general terms holds that you can't bring a civil case that undermines the validity of a previous criminal conviction. Rooker-Feldman is much broader than that. It applies in civil cases, and it has to do, I mean, Heck can deal with a federal conviction too. Rooker-Feldman is about state judgments.
Yes, Your Honor. We claim damages as one of our requests for relief based upon the unconstitutionality of the statute, based upon...
Right, and that's something that could have been raised by appealing the conviction in the first instance, right? Anytime you're convicted, you can appeal.
Yes, Your Honor, you can appeal.
And you can say that the statute under which I was convicted is void because it's unconstitutional and therefore I should not stand convicted. So the question is whether there's some exception to the Heck bar on sort of civil collateral undoing of a criminal conviction.
Well, I don't think we undo the criminal conviction here, Your Honor, and I don't think that's what we intended to do in this.
Well, how would you get damages for being convicted if you were properly convicted?
Well, if you were unlawful, if your rights were violated and you were unlawfully confined in a jail, I believe you could get damages for that confinement. I believe you get damages for your lost wages, if you lost those wages.
Right, but you do so on a theory that it was not proper to convict you. That's your theory. I mean, one could also have they beat me in prison. That's a whole different ball game. But you're saying, I never should have been convicted.
Well, but we are challenging the statute.
I understand that.
But how do you get to that if you aren't addressing the merits of the constitutionality of the ordinance? How do you get to this? How do you get to that determination if the only issue here is whether or not the court had jurisdiction. You never get to the merits then under your theory, right?
Well, you would get to it if the court, if this court reverses the dismissal on mootness and Rooker-Feldman.
For here, how would we make that determination if the merits are not before us? How do we determine the heck question if we can't delve into the merits of whether or not the statute was constitutional?
Well, Your Honor, this was not something that came up until today.
No,
so
it
I
didn't.
Haven't had time
and
to
there's,
figure.
There's, no, I know it was in a footnote or something in the city's briefing, and it's not their claim. So one possible answer to this is that they've waived the opportunity to rely on it, depending on whether it's jurisdictional or not jurisdictional, which we have to sort out. There also are some cases that suggest that if you've already completed your time and you get no benefit in shortening your time, that maybe heck doesn't apply there. So there are some possible exceptions, but it's still of concern to me, at least this member of the panel.
I can appreciate that, Your Honor, and I'm sorry I'm not better prepared because I didn't realize that that was going to be an issue that would be dealt with so specifically today. It wasn't really argued in the district court. I don't believe that the district judge magistrate addressed that.
That's
issue.
True.
So whether whether it's waived or not, I think that's a valid question because obviously the court doesn't really consider things that weren't. Except if it's jurisdictional below. So I would just say that even if our claims for retrospective relief were somehow barred, I still think that our claims for the prospective relief are viable. That the White case and the American Transport case really highlight the why that would be so. If you recall in the White case, we had an assistant secretary issue a memorandum. It had been in effect for 5 years. It provided all the relief that the plaintiffs requested. But what the court said is that the memorandum, quote, was broad in scope and unequivocal in tone. There were very specific guidelines and to protect against violations the First Amendment during so the HUD would not charge these people with violations of the Fair Housing Act. It even said that all decisions had to be conducted in close consultation with counsel. It said that all decisions regarding allegations of violations must be cleared with headquarters before a complaint was filed, and that more importantly that the officials must defer in upholding the constitutional protections and must err on the side of the First Amendment. We don't have that here. The officers are prohibited from even calling the shelters. The special order has holes in it where if a disabled person can't stay or is excluded from a shelter, there's no way of knowing that because they don't report that. If a person is prohibited from staying there because they've reached their maximum stay, we don't know that because they don't report that. And so the officers will write these tickets, and that's what happened. That actually is what happened with the plaintiffs.
Counselor, you have about a minute remaining if you wanted to save a little bit for rebuttal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You have to count your own time.
I mentioned that at the beginning.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Muir. I represent the City of Boise, Boise Police Chief Michael Masterson, and the Boise Police Department. I'd like to acknowledge that with me at council table today is the Boise City Attorney, Carrie Coliani. I'd like to direct my comments first. The district court in this case found two issues. They found the retrospective relief under the Rooker-Feldman, and under mootness, they found the prospective relief. And I think
so. Do you agree with opposing counsel that we're here on procedural questions, not to decide the merits?
I do, Your Honor.
So even if we disagree with the district court, what would happen is to return the case to the district court without deciding anything about the merits, correct? if we think the district court had jurisdiction over some or all claims,
I believe
we would just remand it.
I believe that is correct, Your
Honor. Thank you.
I'd like to state the overall view that the City of Boise has about this matter. It's the City of Boise's position that we have never had a policy and have never actually cited people under the camping or sleeping ordinances when shelters are unavailable. The posture of how this case came about is that counsel for the plaintiffs in this matter approached the City of Boise with concerns that they thought that that it was unconstitutional or ordinances. So we sat down with them under an agreement that we would take a look at it. We still disagreed that we had ever done anything that was unconstitutional, unlawful, or wrongful. So as part of that agreement to sit down and negotiate with them in good faith, we amended the ordinance, and we came up with the special order that you'll see in the record that is a whole program that the homeless shelters will call in and tell the police officers whether or not there is shelter space available.
But counsel, now you're, this is why I asked what I asked at the beginning. Now you're talking to us about the merits. You're saying we have a terrific policy and we don't think there's ever been anything wrong with it. There still isn't. It's even better than it used to be. But all that is about the merits. So why does the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine apply to the decisions of the state court about the guilt of the plaintiffs of violating the ordinance?
Your Honor, I do agree. Rooker-Feldman on the retrospective claim applying to the state court criminal law claims, definitely Rooker-Feldman applies. They are,
why?
Because they're asking for a de facto appeal of those state court judgments.
But are they challenging the citations in any way? Are they saying that the citations should be eradicated or deleted from their criminal histories or any of that?
Correct. They have asked that they reverse the state court fines, the state court costs, the jail fees, and expunge the criminal records. They are asking the federal district court to be the appellate court to sit on that criminal state court judgment, and that's exactly what Rooker-Feldman doesn't allow them to do. They're somehow thinking that the federal district court will be the super appellate court for state court decisions, and that
just can't
happen.
What about in terms of prospective relief?
Well, prospective relief, I believe that it is correct, and the reason I was going
what
in
is correct.
I believe the prospective relief, the court was correct in finding mootness.
Why? That's why it appeared to me from what I read, and counsel confirmed it this morning, that as far as the plaintiffs are concerned, they think that everything that is happening today after the changes in policy remains unconstitutional. They're still challenging it as being wrongful. So they may be incorrect about that. You could win on the merits, but it's not as if they say, you know, there's a stop sign that's in my way and you've taken it out and bulldozed the land. It's not that kind of gone. So if they're still challenging the new form of the ordinance, why is it moot?
Well, I think it is moot, but I will kind of back off on what I said, Your Honor, because I think that does go to the merits. The district court found mootness because of the change in the ordinance.
But why is that correct? If it doesn't solve the problem that is in the complaint, it's like apples and oranges. You know, you've got a complaint about apples and you say, I have brand new oranges. And so they're saying, why does that make the complaint moot?
It makes a difference because the district court did find that the special order did solve the problem.
Well, I know, but we have review of that. So why is that correct?
I believe it's the same analysis that the district court did, and I agree with you. This is de novo, so you can take a look at it on a new basis, but I think that you'll come to the same conclusion, that the district court was right. We have, you had asked us to look closely at White v. Lee and American Cargo, and I think those kind of set forth the mootness issue. And in White, you had a memorandum change that went out. Well, in our case in front of us, we have much larger change that we made by enacting this special order. So our policy is not temporary. It's become entrenched.
What do I make of the district court's statement at page 71 of the record, which I found quite startling coming right before the tagline? The claims for prospective relief are largely moot in light of the city's special order. Well, if they're largely moot, then smallly, there's something still remaining. I don't understand what the district court was doing there, and maybe you can help me out.
Your Honor, to the extent that the district court used the word largely, I really don't know. I think they are moot.
Was he just carving out the vagueness claim that he talks about on the next page? Is that your understanding?
Could be. And you know, the court went on, the district court went on and said that as a matter of law, the unconstitutionally vague, unconstitutionally overbroad claims are gone, and as well as the violation for the constitutional right to travel. And those aren't part of the appeal in front of you. There's the two issues, Rooker-Feldman and mootness. So the court did rule on those, and those haven't been appealed.
The vagueness ruling has not been appealed, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, vagueness, okay. Overbroad, and then they also had a constitutional claim for right to be able to travel, and the district court held that had failed. And so I believe that the appellants
I have some difficulty understanding how the district court could say, I'm going to rule on the merits of some claims, but some claims are moot. And I guess that goes back to the question of whether under plaintiff's complaint, the special order takes away everything that they're complaining about in that aspect of the case. Is that the question we have to answer?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think what the district court is saying is that with this special order, there's no possibility. They felt assured that under the special order, people would not be cited under either camping or sleeping if there was no shelter space available. And that's the whole contention of a plaintiff's Eighth Amendment claims, is that that you're criminalizing homelessness because they don't have any place to go. Well, the special order makes sure that they do have a place to go, that there is shelter space available at that time. And if there is, they're in violation of those ordinances because they could go someplace.
Counsel, does it matter in this case that the criminal convictions were for misdemeanors? Does that matter to the Rooker-Feldman analysis?
Your Honor, I don't know that it does, except for, I mean, you in the state of Idaho, you are in the magistrate. For misdemeanors, you're on a magistrate court level, far removed from the higher state courts.
Yeah, that's my concern, is whether or not the plaintiffs in this case would have had an opportunity to even litigate the constitutional issues before a misdemeanor court.
I think surely they needed to do it if they were going to.
Well, could they? That's Judge Rawlinson's question. Was that
sure.
a possibility?
And they were represented by counsel. I think there was only one of the citations where one of the defendants was pro se. So they had counsel, and the one pro se was advised of his rights that he could get counsel and could get a public defender. So I think absolutely Rooker-Feldman applies that it is a de facto appeal.
Did they all plead guilty?
Yes, they did. There was one or two that had been dismissed, but other than that, they pled guilty. I'd like to, in the last few minutes, go back to White versus Lee and American Cargo, to where I'd just like to emphasize that the city of Boise, in changing the ordinance and in coming up with the special order, they worked with the whole community on this. They got buy-in from the homeless shelters that they would call in and advise whether or not they had space. They arranged for a dispatcher that would dispatch it to the officers out in the field so that they would know. And they got buy-in all the way up the chain.
Were there representatives from the homeless community there?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The homeless shelter people were the ones that were the special order was worked out with.
Counsel, in view of your references several times in your argument to the city's willingness to be cooperative, in your view, is this a case that would benefit from our mediation services to work out ordinances and procedures that would satisfy everyone? You may not have authority to answer that.
Your Honor, I don't think it would, because I think my view is that we really did do everything that needed to be done to make sure that the ordinance was constitutional and that people were not being cited if they didn't have a place to go.
But the fact that it's being challenged means that perhaps you were not as successful as you hoped you would be.
Well, Your Honor, I'd beg to differ. I think if you look at the record, you'll never find anything in the record other than people saying, well, when I got cited, I had no place to go. But there's nothing in the record that shows that anybody was actually cited when they had no place to go. A lot of those people didn't want to go to a shelter, but there's shelter space available. So I would refer you to the record, and I don't think you'll find any place where...
There's evidence in the record that some of the shelters had conditions that were not acceptable, such as not accepting families together. There's a question as to whether or not there was shelter available if it was conditioned on matters that were unacceptable.
Well, that was the object of this special order, is there's several homeless shelters in Boise, and it addressed the different populations. So it addressed whether or not there is a homeless shelter available for men, if there's homeless shelter available for women, and if there's homeless shelter available for women with children. And the protocol is such that if any one of those populations are not covered, if there's no shelter space available, they will not be cited.
Of course, that's the merits, and we're not here on that. But
to some extent, they go to the merits to the extent of whether or not it's moot. Because the district court had to say, look, I looked at the special order, and it resolves it.
But you have to look at it next to the complaint, not next to the real world as you see it. Because the complaint defines what the plaintiffs think is wrong. And so if they think 10 things are wrong, and you think 5 things are wrong, and you fix those 5, it doesn't make the matter moot. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're talking to us about how the special order fixes the real world. But to me, the question is, how does the special order read side by side with the complaint? Because that's the only way it can be rendered moot as distinct from decided on the merits. And so I'm having difficulty seeing why everything that is said in the complaint no longer could apply.
Well, Your Honor,
for example, you've just named off men, women, and women with children, but you haven't named couples with children or disabled individuals. I mean, there's stuff in here that isn't, to my view, covered by the special order. Looking at the complaint, not saying whether it's right or wrong.
Well, and I guess I don't have an answer for you there, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the special order addressed the homeless populations that they saw that were out there. It does refer to the people that they need to keep in mind disabilities and such, but the district court found that they thought that it was sufficient that people couldn't be cited if they didn't have a place to go.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Belloc.
I guess I do have more minutes. So.
No, you're minus minute 46.
Okay. I won't try to get back up. Thank you.
No, we won't make you give it back, so we'll listen to everything. So
must be the time zone change, Your Honor.
Let me just ask one question. Did Plaintiff Godfrey ever cited for a violation?
Yes.
Of an ordinance?
Yes, he was the one who was cited. He has numerous medical conditions. He was the one cited for being along the river where he found a blanket and stayed the night, and the officer came upon him and cited him for camping. He was physically unable to go.
Where do I find that? You don't need to look for it now.
It's in my brief. I separate each plaintiff. I'm sure it's right there. I just quickly want to jump through the Rooker-Feldman, and I think it's most important. Rooker-Feldman really doesn't concern when the adverse party is not a state court judge, and it's a city, the city ordinance here. And we did not complain.
Counsel, I just want to go to the question that Judge Graber asked. Were you about the possibility of working this out in mediation. Were you involved before?
Yes, I've been involved from day one, Your Honor, and I will say we attempted to mediate before we filed this case, and we were not invited to the special order. The special order is a non-public document. There's no way a person will know about it. We were not asked to comment on it before it was adopted, and so I disagree with counsel on that. I would note for the court that we were invited, and I did fill out that mediation statement after the notice was filed. We had a telephone conference. Counsel indicated basically his position he had today, and that's where it stood.
That's fine. Not everybody.
Right.
Not everybody's client is willing, and that's
counsel. May I ask you this question about the Rooker-Feldman doctrine? Counsel for the city represented that the plaintiffs were seeking for the convictions to be expunged, for the fines to be to be given back to them. So does that, in your view, challenge the criminal conviction?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the court's decisions are very specific about it has to seek to vacate or set aside an erroneous decision of the state court. And we did not do that. And I think it was in the
But aren't you doing that indirectly by saying we want these convictions expunged, we want the fines refunded? But isn't that an indirect challenge to the conviction?
Well, as for expungement is not a challenge to the conviction. Expungement under Idaho law, and I think this is generally true, is an equitable remedy that says that the court expunges it from the record. It does not mean the conviction is overturned, not at all, both under Idaho rules. I cite this in my brief.
How about the funds, the refund of the fines?
Then? Well, he classifies that as refund of funds. We don't say it's a refund. We say that's part of our damages. They also had jail incarceration costs assessed for them for being in jail. So there are numerous elements of damages here that have nothing to do with the underlying court judgment. So we don't think that those in and of them themselves, under the cases under Noel, there were four state court lawsuits between the parties before the Noel challenged in federal court the constitutionality of in his case.
Counsel, I think if the court has no more questions, if you'll wrap up, because you also have exceeded your time.
Yes, I'll give
you a few seconds to wrap up if you'd like.
It's our position, Your Honor, that the court erred in dismissing this case for on mootness grounds and under the Rooker-Feldman, and we believe that it is proper for the court to remand this case on the merits and let the decision on the merits be done in the district court in the first instance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the arguments of both parties. They've been very helpful on this interesting and difficult case. The case is submitted, and we stand adjourned for this session.